Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 348 for September 23 of 2016. Chianti Classico and Lusso, the story of the Fiat 124. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Well, welcome, everybody, to another edition of Autoline After Hours. John McElroy here. My co-host, Gary Vasilash, is out traveling right now. He had the show last week. I got the show this week. But I also have to say we got two other people helping me out today. Bob Gritzinger with Ward's Auto and Todd Lassa with Automobile Magazine. Great having the both of you guys here. Back!
Look out.
Look out.
Hello, John. Yes.
But we got to let everybody know, too, that our special guest for today's show is Leah Horton, and she's the program manager on the Fiat 124. And welcome to Autoline After Hours, Leah.
Thank you.
So, and we got your baby here in the studio, too.
Yes, that is my baby.
So tell me how this program was run, because clearly, you know, this is based off the mechanicals of a Mazda Miata, but it's a Fiat, which presumably would have been done out of Torino, Italy. But here we have Leah Horton here, who I presume works in Auburn Hills, Michigan.
Yes.
So how did that all come together? Italy, Japan, Michigan.
Well, really, this was a global project, and it was based off of the a proven platform of the MX-5. And we really wanted to take that platform and build a unique Fiat Spider. We needed to make this truly our own. And in order to do that, it had its unique powertrain coming from Termoli. And then the styling was also done in Italy from Centro Stile. And then we also had a global team in the United States working with program management, vehicle integration. We also had a team in APAC doing powertrain integration.
And what's APAC?
In Japan.
Okay.
Asia-Pacific.
Okay, Asia-Pacific, yes. Part of FCA.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So we had resident engineers working there on the powertrain specific, both for powertrain integration and powertrain electrical. And so as you can see, the whole exterior of the vehicle is completely unique. And we wanted to style this vehicle to pay homage to the previous Fiat 124 Spider, which in 2016, 50 years later, we brought this car to development. And it does pay homage. Some of the styling characteristics on the rear, you'll see that there's a swallow in terms of the headlamps to the rear fascia. And then on the sides, there's a distinct character line that follows through, which is the same characteristic that the previous Fiat 124 had. And then the front, we kept the same styling of the front headlamps, really to be more rounded with the LED headlamps, and kind of have a personality to the front where you can, it almost looks like a face with the smile and the eyes, but we really wanted to keep the same characteristics of the previous Fiat 124 Spider and just modernize it. And then we also added a lot of unique safety features to bring this into a modern world. So you'll see blind spot monitoring, rear backup camera. And then we also changed some material in the interior with some unique features in the interior as well, really to make the interior more of a comfortable, soft touch feeling. And the seat bolstering, we changed the seat bolstering to have it, you feel more connected to the road when you're driving. And taking this car back and forth for the past year and a half, I've had a lot of miles in these cars, and there really is no seat fatigue for driving for a long period of time. So we really wanted to pay special attention, not only making the car comfortable, but also to have it be a sporty car. Not necessarily one that you would just have as a racer car, but one that you could have as an everyday driving. And I really think we did that on this car.
Mm-hmm.
I think you offer a Recaro seat option?
Yes,
yeah,
Recaro
that's right. The one I drove for a feature we did that's in the upcoming issue, actually. features had that seat, and that was a fabulous seat, a fabulous interior on the car, very comfortable, in a very, very much a sports car way. I have to ask, though, since you talk about the kind of, I guess, multicultural or multi-nation effort put into this car, that since World War II, European and Asian brand sports cars have relied on the U.S. market as being often 50% of any given sports car, whether it was Fiat or Alfa Romeo or MG or Austin Healey or whatever. And I wonder if that's what you're expecting from this car and if that may have played into the decision to do a lot of the planning here in the United States.
We really wanted to make this make this be a global car. It's going to be sold around the world, so it's sold global markets. But in order to really design this car to be adaptable to all sorts of road conditions, to all sorts of comfort levels, we needed to have a team in each region developing this car. So when we did our development trips, we traveled all around the world for 3.5 years. And I think what we ended up was a global car that really can be sold around the world, not specific to any market, except, of course, for homologation regulation requirements.
So there's no real difference in the car sold here versus car sold in Italy versus a car sold in Japan, other than those safety regs and so on.
Correct. Right. Mm-hmm. It's the same car.
Mm-hmm.
And you were lucky. You got to manage this program from the drawings.
From the drawings.
To it running down the assembly line.
Yes.
So that's got to be a little bit unique. But I think, and we were talking before the show about this, this gives you tremendous knowledge about the whole program. It's got to be the right way to do it, I think. Leave one person in charge for the whole thing.
Actually, there were quite a few of us that have stayed on the program from the beginning to the end. And just having that background and that knowledge from the beginning to launching the car and have it actually be on the road at the end, it took a global team to do that, and it took a lot of hard work and dedication to do that. It was, boy, the communication needed to be rock solid. You needed to put a lot of time. It was a 24/7 job because you have to bridge all three time zones.
Not only that, you got to bridge three languages.
And three languages. So it was, you needed to make sure you had effective communication. But I can't stress enough how lucky we were to be on this program from the very beginning to the end, because it really showed a testament to how good the car was and how proud we all are of this car.
So, obvious question, a small car working with another manufacturer, FCA is getting out of the small car business, and the boss has made it clear that he would like to have a partner somewhere out there if FCA is going to continue in small, mid-size, that 200 range. So, is that your next project? Where do we take this from here?
Honestly, I don't know what the golden plan is. I just know
you seem
that
to work well with Mazda.
We had a great working relationship. I mean, the two OEMs working together cohesively, we developed great friendships. I mean, I have a lot of friends now in Japan that I can call up and say, hey, if I'm in Japan, can I call you up and can we go out to dinner?
Mazda 3.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. That's you know. Bob's point is that Mazda is a small car company, one of the smallest. It's not a full line, but it's got a decent sized lineup,
right.
And it just seems like there could be some other opportunities there. The contract
between the truck company and the car company is that what we're talking about?
Well, I mean, the contract with Mazda on this car was a one-time contract, right? It only applies to this car, or
the contract was specific for the Spider.
Yeah. And is it one generation? Will we see the Fiat Spider going forward for many years to come, I hope?
I don't know. I mean, we had during the contract, we had a set number of years that we were going to have the Spider sell for. Mm-hmm. What the future plans are, I really can't comment on that. I know in the future that we're a car company. We need to make cars, so the best decisions will be made in order for us to sell cars and take advantage of technologies.
Sounds like you're in a good position to be part of that, too, so that's...
I hope I have the chance to.
The marketplace will decide, right? If this thing sells well, I'm sure they're going to say, let's keep this going, and if it doesn't sell well or the Miata doesn't either,
we have to be realistic here since you bring that up. This is a sports car. We love sports cars. We want to see it do well, but it is not built to be what we would consider a volume
vehicle kind of volume
of any
it's
sort.
Like 10,000? What's the number?
The numbers are usually very good for the first model year, and then they trail off a little bit.
But what helps is this is a global car. So,
yes.
I'm sure there's still markets that this has not hit yet.
Correct.
And it's probably going to take several years to hit all the markets. So that's going to help it and, have a longer life.
Correct.
And I got to believe that Mazda is thrilled to be able to split the cost of the program with you guys and vice versa. You couldn't do this without Mazda. I'm not sure they could have done the Miata not if they didn't know that Fiat was there to help.
On the street is that they would not have been able to do the ND Miata without the deal with FCA.
Okay.
I don't know.
So
if you have anything to say about that,
then.
But if you do, here's your chance.
So what about other iterations, potentially? I mean,
we got a question here from Sean Sweeney, who wrote in via Facebook. He says, will the Fiat 124 Spider America be coming to America? And apparently this must be something that Fiat in Europe is doing. So, but you don't have an answer for that, right?
Yeah, I honestly don't know what the plan is for that America. I haven't seen any. I've really just been focusing on launching the Classica, the Lusso, and the Abarth Fiat 124 Spider. That's been my main focus.
Gotcha. Okay.
Abarth, what a fun driving car that is. Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
So you both have driven the Abarth.
Been on track in it, and that's the place. I mean, I'd love to get it out on the road, but getting a chance on a track at
My plug for Automobile Magazine is our November issue. We'll have my drive. I wouldn't call it a comparison exactly. I couched it in terms of anti-autonomy. Here's how to move forth into the autonomous world with two cars that you have to drive yourself. And it was, of course, the latest Miata Club and the Fiat 124 Spider. I forgot the long name, but I'll just call it the Abarth with a manual, both with manuals on a very remote highway in central California, and it was a blast. Both cars were a blast.
Uh-huh. So what about other iterations? I mean, there's always it seems like there's Mazda does a number of different varieties. The power folding hardtop, did you look at that as a possibility for 124?
I'm not really sure what their long-term plan is, what the other items are in the product line for this particular car. Like I said, I've just really been focusing on launching this particular car with this product grid.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about a change that has been made that, I guess being too much of a sports car geek, I brought this up with Ralph Gilles when we got a preview of this car in the design center at Fiat Chrysler in Auburn Hills. And at the time, the Lusso, which is the luxury version of the Spider, was going to be automatic only. I said to Ralph, and I understand every car, sells more automatics now than manuals, except for maybe one of these. But even the percentage of automatics on a car like this, it's heresy, but that's the case.
Keeps wrapping off. Yeah.
And he said, "Well, I don't know, but I'll talk to the board members about it." And at the introduction in San Diego County in June, we were told that the Lusso would get the manual as an option, or would be available with a manual. So how did that, can you talk a little bit about how that came about?
Clearly there was a board discussion about Todd Lassa.
Yeah, they said Todd Lassa.
What he had to say.
I should say that I was not the only auto journalist to raise this issue.
Yeah, but you're the one that they recognized.
Oh, no. So, very funny.
So how did it go?
Yeah, how did it go? Yeah, how did that happen?
How was it? Were you at that board table?
No, I was not at that board table. What I can say is we had many ride and drive events with our leadership, and they were able to drive both the automatic and the manual back-to-back. So perhaps coming out of those drive events, they realized, hey, maybe we do need to consider offering the manual on the Lusso as well instead of just the automatic.
Forever to be known as the Ted Lasso moment.
Yeah. We can call it that.
No, don't call it that. Honestly, I'm not the only one. I just happened to mention it to Mr. Gilles, and as I say, obviously, many others said something. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. No,
wonderful.
Yeah. Leah, what was the toughest part doing this program for you? What was the biggest challenge?
Honestly, it was the communication, effective communication.
And this program must have been run in English then, or was
yes,
it?
Yes, the primary language was English. So
which makes it easy on you, harder on the Italians and the Japanese. Right?
Yeah, but you still, I mean, it's all in your speech. You have to speak very slowly so that, you know, our Italian counterparts are able to hear us. Our Japanese counterparts, they speak English very well.
But it's a second language. So
yes.
It's never just as natural.
Right. During meetings, making sure you're, you know, writing meeting minutes, making sure everything is very clear and understood. Don't walk away from the meeting until everyone's understood exactly what was said, what the next steps are. Communication by far was the most challenging aspect of this program.
So what'd you learn? I mean, you mentioned a couple of things there. Speak slowly and distinctly. Make sure everyone's on board before you leave the meeting. What else? Because we have a lot of people who are in program development that listen to the show, and maybe you got a few pointers for them.
I would say, you know, those two points that I just mentioned, but also patience. You need to have patience because people learn and speak, you know, at different tones, different speed, and you need to be able to listen to one another and understand what the other person's saying and make sure you really understand what they're saying and not just what you think that they're saying. Don't ever assume, because their language assumption could be different than our language assumption, and you need to be on the same page before you walk away from a meeting, a conference call. Telepresence were also very helpful, especially at the beginning of the relationship, face-to-face and telepresence. That way you get to understand one another and you can read your body language, and because body language speaks volumes versus voice, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So if you see the body language and you see they're tensing up and, you know, okay, maybe I need to say this a different way. Maybe I need to change my tone a different way. To me, it was eye-opening trying to communicate with three different cultures. It was a great experience. Fantastic.
How often was Sergio Marchione directly involved? Because we know, obviously, he's got so many things to do with basically two car companies. And he can't concentrate on any one single model. But we know that he's also got an enthusiast bent to him, and he probably had maybe a little more interest in this car than some of the other new products. How much input did you feel you had from him?
Honestly, it was just the global team. I never had one-on-one conversations with Sergio. It was just our global team working on the car. And
well, let me ask this. At one point, he switched brands for the car, you know what I mean, right?
In our long-range plan, I think it was at the Investor Day, I'm not exactly sure what time it was, we had a vehicle in there that said specialty vehicle. Who knew what brand that was going to be at that time? It was a specialty vehicle that was going to be made. It ended up being the Fiat 124 Spider.
Okay.
We've got a number of other questions that have come in here. Scott from California wants to know, can you give us some specifics about the car, powertrain, MPGs, that sort of thing?
Yes, so the...
Could I pass her the awards?
I got it.
No, I bet she's got that at the top of her head.
So the powertrain is a 1.4 liter turbo.
Fiat powertrain.
It's a Fiat powertrain. It comes out of Termoli, Italy. Yeah. It the vehicle achieves 160 horsepower on the Classic and Lusso, 164 horsepower on the Abarth. It's 184 pound-foot of torque. On the Abarth, when you get the Sport, you get a Sport button. So when you push the Sport mode, you actually receive the 184 pound-foot of torque at 2,500 RPM versus 3,200 RPM.
Yeah. Hmm. So, hey, Armand here wants to know, too, why is the exhaust note of the 124 Spyder Abarth so much toned down compared to the Fiat 500 Abarth?
There are pass-by regulations that we need to meet. The regulation testing has changed year to year. So in order for us to meet the global pass-by regulations, the exhaust note was tuned as such.
You know, so does that mean bad news for the wonderful exhaust note on the Fiat Cinquecento Abarth?
That I can't answer. I have no idea.
See, I thought the Fiat 500 Abarth was a little too noisy.
Yeah.
Amazingly, for the first time ever, my wife disagrees with me. She loves the exhaust tone of that.
But she's only in it a short time.
That's right.
So, well, that's whatever country is behind that, that needs to change.
Well, there's active exhaust systems you can put on the cars.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, look, we're going to have to wrap this segment up. But, Leah, thanks so much for coming by and bringing us up to speed on the Fiat 124. I think they nailed the styling, by the way. Even though this is nothing like the old 124, I instantly recognized it as a 124. Mm-hmm. So let the stylists know. They nailed it.
I will. Thank you very much.
Real good. We're going to have to take a quick break right now, but we'll be back to talk about some of the news in the industry right after this message from Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Just to keep her on her toes. I don't know.
Well, we're back. So let's talk about some of the things that have been going on in the industry. Have you guys been any place super interesting, driven anything really good?
I've been homebound for a couple of months.
I have been not out and about.
Me neither. That's why I'm asking.
I mean, you know, a couple, the local program we were both at recently.
For ZF. In fact, well, let's start off by talking about that. I think we got a clip that we showed on AutoLine Daily today, too. Carmen, if we can bring that up, that four-wheel steer system on the F-150. Do we have that?
That is dramatic, though. I drove it. It's there. That's what they're saying is the turning circle of a Ford Escape.
And yet this is a Ford F-150 quad cab.
145-inch quad cab, you know.
145-inch wheelbase quad cab.
Yeah.
Do they give a number for that turning circle?
The turning radius? No, they didn't.
Whatever an Escape is.
Yeah.
38 feet, maybe 40 or something like that. It seems like it was down,
right?
Like on that scale.
But they had a button, you know,
to 38 maybe.
Got it.
Yeah. So they had the proverbial engineering button, so they could turn the four wheel steer on and off. So at first
the articulation in the back.
I was going to say that
12 degrees.
Wow.
Yeah.
Of rear steer.
Mm-hmm.
And does that switch? Does it go opposite the front wheels and then same as the front wheels, depending on
contraphase and in phase
at speed? Yeah,
right.
Okay.
Yeah. So I did a couple of emergency lane change maneuvers too, and they had this truck in the video clip doesn't show it, but they had, I can't remember, it was like 1,000 pounds in the bed.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm doing these, you know, abrupt yank on the wheel, you know, back to back four wheel steer versus just two wheel steer, and man. What a difference having four-wheel steering, making an emergency lane change.
Right, yeah. It was they had impressive stuff out there. But, you know, this goes back to
that
people have done all-wheel steer
and
quadra-steer. And I mentioned quadra-steer in particular because it was an expensive option. It was
started out at $5,600. This was in 2002, when that was even more money than
it was part of a package, I believe.
And let me just say, Quadrasteer does nothing for you in Michigan black mud.
Oh.
Nothing.
Well, that's a better
anecdote. The guy in the Ford tow truck that pulled me out, he laughed about that.
That's a better anecdote than I have. I've never gotten one of those in mud, but I was out at out in the California desert with Motor Trend doing Truck of the Year when that truck came out. And I thought it was so good that I wrote in my notes, and I think it was published in the piece, that this is as much a breakthrough for trucks as the self-starter was for cars in 1912.
Oh, yeah, it wasn't
quite that. I was a bit off on that one.
Quite there.
Well, you know, Todd, I think your instincts were right. But it flopped in the marketplace when it was Quadrasteer. But remember, Honda had it on, I want to say it was like the 1986 Prelude. And Mazda had it on, I think it was the 87 626. The Honda system was purely mechanical, which was pretty intriguing. Mazda had an electronically controlled system. Again, it fizzled in the marketplace. Nobody saw the value in it. But I loved Quadrasteer when it came out because... just like this thing that ZF has.
Right.
Takes a big honking SUV or full-size pickup and makes it very maneuverable. Even shines better when you're towing a trailer. You get zero trailer sway. And when you're backing up, you know, if you're backing up with a trailer, you have to sort of turn opposite what your intuition says as you're backing up a trailer. Not so with four-wheel steering. You just steer the way your brain tells you you should steer. And it's so much easier to back up with a trailer with this thing.
Now, is the idea that in a production model you would have, would there be any reason to lock that out?
No.
Or did they just did that to show you the difference?
Just to show you the benefits.
Right.
You know, they could instantly say, this is what every other F-150 drives like. Now let's hit the button and here's what it's like with four-wheel steering.
Really,
I mean, in those low-speed maneuvering exercises, just unbelievable.
So I asked them, are you guys, did some OEM come to you and say, we got to do this? I said, no, we're just doing it. It's a build it and they will come kind of approach to it.
Right.
But what I like about this is so many people go, ugh, I don't want a, you know, a Suburban. I don't want a Tahoe. I don't want a Navigator. They're just too damn big. They're too hard to park. They're too hard. This takes away that problem. I mean, you know, it makes it very easy to take a very big vehicle and maneuver it in tight spaces and park it.
Yeah, doing that parking exercise was instructive.
What was, remind me, was Quadrasteer a Delphi product? That's right. And that was Delphi. Just right about the same time as the separation of Delphi from GM, if I'm, or maybe a little bit after.
Yeah, it was a little bit, it was already Delphi when they did that.
And There's a bit of articulation, if I'm not mistaken, I could be mistaken, on the Acura RLX now, I believe. They do just a little bit of that for handling purposes.
There's quite a few cars right now. Cadillac CT6 has got it. Porsche, Infiniti. There's a number of cars out right now with four-wheel steering.
Mechanical.
Yeah. Oh, you know, I asked them.
Full steering.
I know. Like you said, 12 degrees.
12 and a half, something.
Like that. And I asked them, well, how come you guys can get 12 and a half and on the CT6 you can only get 3 degrees? And they said, there's not enough room for the wheels to turn.
Right.
You know, you get a truck, you got these big, gigantic wheel wells. You can turn the wheels a whole lot more.
Blame the 20-inch wheels again,
right? You don't necessarily need to on a, you know, CT6. You don't need that much.
I think they'd take more if they had it, if they could do it. Because when I first got in the CT6, you know, I just jumped in the car. I wasn't on the launch. You know, I wasn't up to speed on it. And I had to do, a U-turn, and it was all of a sudden, wow, this thing's got a good turning radius. And I mentioned it to Sean here in the shop. He goes, duh, it's got four-wheel steering. That's when I really started to pay attention and then really noticed it. But it's not as noticeable as it was on that pickup.
Yeah, that was huge. Yeah. So other programs, geez, I'm trying to think. I think the last thing I was out on was maybe the Volvo S90, something like that. But we just finished up doing our Ward's Auto UX testing, which was
user experience,
several months of going back into essentially an offshoot of interiors testing, but adding in all of that adaptive cruise control, lane keeping, all those kinds of things, and picking our best. And we just announced those. So that's been
That's been
keeping us busy. Well, BMW 7 Series certainly hits it out of the park.
No kidding.
On the low end.
At an affordable level.
Hyundai Elantra made our list. No,
Hyundai's really good at HMI stuff.
Yeah, and no stop and go because it doesn't have, I've learned from the Hyundai people, if you don't have an electronic parking brake, you can't do stop and go.
What do you mean?
Cruise control.
Cruise control.
You can't bring it down and hold it.
Oh.
Right? I never knew that.
Yeah, which was news. To, you know, I said, how come, you know, how come the Sonata comes down to a stop, but this Elantra won't? And that's why. So, people.
Here you are trying to do a show and people have the nerve to call you.
Well, yeah. Who knows? Maybe they have a question. But so that's, you know, that was a $27,000 vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And
Made
the list with, you know, and some amazing things, some great, you know, voice controls, things like that. So, but so that's kind of taken up a lot of time around my shop lately.
Gotcha. Hey, look, let's take a real quick break. We got a whole lot of other topics to talk about right now, but quick promo. Let's run it, Carmen.
From Shanghai to the Silicon Valley, the auto industry may make news around the globe, but there's only one spot to get your daily dose. Check out AutoLine Daily at AutoLine.tv, Monday through Friday at noon Eastern.
Okay, we're back. Of course, the big news this week has been all these rumors that Apple was going to buy McLaren. Mm. And then, Todd, what do you make of all of this?
It's funny. I picked that up from the, well, the story came from the Financial Times yesterday. And by the time I wrote up our own little version saying, you know, that that Fernando Alonso might be the first to drive an Apple car.
or ride in one.
Just shortly afterward, I got the call back from the U.S. PR person who put out the denial.
And from McLaren.
From McLaren. Yeah. I'm sorry, the McLaren PR person. And the denial was that there's been no talk of any kind of financial interest, that Apple would not be buying McLaren outright or buying a portion of McLaren or buying, you know, whatever, which is interesting, too, because you have to kind of separate, although it's, I guess it's all one company. You have McLaren Technologies and you've got McLaren Automotive, which is making the high-end sports cars all the way up to the P1. Uh-huh. And then you have McLaren Formula One, the famed F1 team, and of which Fernando Alonso is a driver, in case someone out there is not familiar with him. So, you know, thinking about it, so there's been a lot of emphasis on the fact that McLaren has a lot of know-how on the technical side with carbon fiber. Their cars, their sports cars, are carbon fiber monocoques, basically, and also aluminum. And that made me think back to when Roush did the Google mobiles for Google, the autonomous little...
Right, yeah.
Uh-huh. It looked like the
bubble car,
and that Roush, they used Roush in a way that I think Apple might be looking at, or may have looked at McLaren, thinking McLaren has the know-how to do this sort of thing on a one-off. I think that might be the case. I don't know for sure, but I suspect that it's more of that than. You know, then we're going to buy McLaren and have
what
them
the
suddenly. I have them. Although it makes a lot. I believe me, I would rather have a tech company get involved with an auto company instead of another tech company, as has been, like Tesla. Even though it's a car company, it's really a tech company, and they don't know any more about manufacturing cars than Apple does, as far as I'm concerned.
Right, right.
And
tech company,
they do great cars, but they have they have those problems. Mm-hmm. I mean, the all the vagaries of. The high costs of doing a car program are something that Silicon Valley, I think, still does not get. And as I've said probably too many times, I probably want an Apple car as much as I'd want a Chevrolet iPhone.
Right, right.
So, you know.
It's a good line.
I'll use that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, but certainly, I think it's pretty clear when you parse McLaren's denial.
Yeah.
Something's going on between those companies.
Right.
Some sort of tech development, something like that.
It leaves open that portion where maybe Apple would contract with McLaren, or maybe they were at least talking to them and considering that.
Or develop the car.
To develop the car, right. That's what I mean, yes.
You know, because, you know, McLaren Engineering is into all kinds of high-tech stuff. You know, on a more local scale here, Pratt & Miller, which runs Corvette Racing, you can't believe what they do in aerospace and military stuff, you know, super top secret stuff. They're into all kinds of software and materials and electronics and you name it. So is McLaren Engineering.
Yeah.
So it would be a natural for an Apple to go, hey, look, because the rumors on the street are that they've cleaned house of a lot of people at Apple who were working on Project Titan. They're a secret that nobody's supposed to know about, but somehow we know the name of the program and the fact that a bunch of people have been let go. So maybe you go all of a sudden as a tech company, to your point, in Silicon Valley, maybe this is harder than we thought to build a car and design one. So you go to a McLaren.
Well, and let's talk about Apple and Google, all the parallels. I mean, I think Apple Google now is what Apple Microsoft used to be, which is what Chevy Ford, Volvo versus Saab. Saab's gone, of course, but, you know, Toyota versus Honda, Mercedes versus BMW is. And you know, Google's autonomous car program is starting to lag behind, too, with all the announcements made in the last few weeks. And
from other car companies. Other car companies are going to be right there with Google. And they're a car company.
Yeah,
you know, Google's got all this great autonomous technology, but who's going to buy it?
Yeah. And then you have getting back to Tesla, of course, Tesla's first product used basically a Lotus body with an electric motor in it. So you could look at it that way. Obviously, McLaren would design an entirely new body for Apple if indeed they go ahead with any kind of a program together.
Yeah.
It's just interesting to watch this stuff develop. You know, were you at Ford in the past week or so down at, you know, I mean, clearly Ford is planting its flag in the middle of all of this autonomous technology stuff and saying, you know, look at us, Wall Street. We're a car company.
I know, but Wall Street doesn't care.
We understand this.
Yeah.
We understand this. Look at us, you know.
And I find the interesting thing there that Ford, for many years, and especially when I started covering autonomy rather closely, was pretty quiet about its program. And GM was fairly quiet about it, too, but they talk a little bit about the Cadillac Super Cruise that we're still now expecting to show up sometime in 2017. And you'd hear, you know, about Volvo, which used to be part of Ford Motor Company and so on and so forth. And all of a sudden, Ford's kind of like, oh, here, we're going to be ahead of everybody. And they've done it fairly quietly up until now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, Ford and GM both, I think, are hyper-aggressive about this whole move into mobility.
Yeah.
Other car companies, too, but at this snapshot in time, it seems to me that Ford and GM are more aggressive, acquiring more capabilities than anybody else.
Yeah. You think there might be a little bit of, you know, they went through a period, and when I say a period of decades now, where they were kind of both brandished as, oh, they're so far behind, they just don't get it the way Toyota or Mercedes or Volkswagen or, you know, any of those, any of the foreign competition does, that they're just so far behind the times that it's almost like they're hypersensitive to it.
Well, they are. But, you know, again, the bankruptcies changed everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Ford didn't go through bankruptcy, but it came damn close to it. And it went through the same changes that GM and Chrysler did. Mm-hmm. And what was their problem? They were saddled with these legacy costs. You know, they had to spend $1 billion a year each to pay people to stay home in the jobs bank and not work.
Right.
They had this billions, tens of billions of unfunded pension that they had to keep funding. They had all this health care that they had to keep going. They didn't have the money to spend like other car companies did on stuff. They also made boneheaded management decisions.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not trying to exonerate them from everything.
Sure.
But those legacy costs are gone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, look at the money they've got to spend now on this technology.
And now the big question for them regarding maintaining a certain labor force and maintaining a certain capacity is, if we go to a shared economy that includes shared cars, shared autonomous electric cars, blah, 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 you know, will these cars being used, you know, 20 hours a day instead of 3 hours a day or whatever it is, mean that they'll be wearing out after 3 years, so we'll still be building, you know, yeah. 18 or 19, not, I think 16 or 15, 16, 17 million a year.
Seems like, yeah, I mean, that's a good take on, you know, their look at how all of this car sharing and autonomy may work in their favor in that, you know, people are, you keep hearing, well, if people share cars, then you're going to sell fewer cars. Well, but if people share cars and the car is running 20 hours a day, it's going to need replacement.
It gets back to the Apple model. Think about how, you know, my wife just got a new iPhone because her old one kind of wore out, and she waited until the new 7 came out. And, you know, iPhones or laptop computers or whatever, you know, you go 2, 3, 4 years, kind of what the typical auto trade-in was back in the 1960s,
Put 100,000 miles on that laptop, and it's done.
Can the car companies get back to that model?
Well,
they may have to.
I don't know. People are used to
the answer.
Well, look, people are used to cars
and
now
what we have
broken in at 100,000.
But look what changed it. You know, because if you go back to the 50s, they did change the styling every single year.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, every single year.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
But you know, Chevrolet had like four models.
Yeah.
You know, they had a truck, they had the Corvette, and they had the Chevy and like the Nomad, and that was it.
Right.
So a Chevy sedan had a million units of sales, million.
Right. Yeah.
So you could pay for all the tooling.
Yeah.
And as the market started to fragment into more and more and more models,
right,
you couldn't recoup all the tooling cost in 1 year. You had to let it go at least 4 years.
Right.
And that's for the exterior sheet metal. And for all the stuff underneath, you had to let it go 8 years, which is where we're at today.
Well, and switching from body on frame to unibody.
Right.
Yeah, that helps, yeah. Yeah, or that affects it somewhat.
But the
big thing is, yeah, if you're going to wear out a car in 3 years, not 11 and a half like the average age is today, you bet. I think we could go back to much faster design changes again.
That'd be interesting.
I think the car companies certainly see where they're going to be players in that whole shared economy, and they want to get in early and again.
Look, a year ago, year and a half ago, Silicon Valley thought it was going to take over the auto industry.
Right.
Now we see Apple cutting back on its car staff, right? We see Google going, hey, who are we going to sell this stuff to? FCA? Okay, lots of luck with that, guys.
Yeah.
And
Tesla going, oh, hey, did we say drive our car like that?
Yeah.
Wait, hold on. Hold on. Oh, wait.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. So
beta testing on the road doesn't work.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Unless you're
What do you guys make of this latest version 8.0 that Tesla's coming out with?
Keeps kids and pets cool or warm, I guess, is the main thing. I don't know. I think they've been too aggressive with what autopilot is supposed to be and letting it out. And this bothered me when Elon Musk started talking about autonomy maybe 2 years ago and said, okay, we'll have that in a year, and made it sound like, okay, we're just getting started on it. We'll have it for you in a year. Now, of course, they bought everything the way everybody else does from Tier 1 and et cetera, suppliers. But how quickly did they put that together? I mean, they need to be a little bit more conservative, but they built such a reputation for we just see something and we see a need for change, we change it right away to serve the customer. And, you know, again, that's beta testing on the road.
Yeah, well, starting by calling it autopilot, you know, in contrast, Volvo, the very safe car company, calls theirs Pilot Assist.
Yeah.
And they're very clear, Assist.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing,
and
you know,
they have a very good system. They could have called it autopilot.
Right. And they have programs to test these in very controlled situations before they let it get too loose.
Plus, I didn't hear the CEO of Volvo coming out and saying, "Hey, you can go from San Francisco to Seattle without having to do anything. The car will drive it yourself."
Yeah,
you know, they didn't do that.
Videos, show people.
So, look,
anyway,
I commend Tesla for updating the system.
Yeah.
But to your point, Todd, when it comes to safety systems, never beta test with your customers. Never, 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 never.
Right.
But I think they've got one whale of a lawsuit that they're facing over. There's been now a couple of accidents. There's this new one in China where they claimed that autopilot was engaged when this guy was killed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they're in trouble in court. They'll lose these cases.
Yeah. I've got so many other issues going on, including SolarCity. Being a problem.
Investment.
Right. Anyway.
Hey, time to take another quick break. We've still got plenty of other topics to talk about here, but Carmen, let's give a shout out to our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back. Hey, what do you guys make of this report that came out by the AAA, the Automobile Association of America, that said, hey, all you people buying premium fuel, you're wasting your money. In fact, you're spending about $2 billion on this premium fuel that your cars don't need.
Depends on where you get your fuel, I suppose.
And it depends on your car. I mean, we have one car that recommends premium fuel, it's a Miata, and it gets decent fuel mileage, and doesn't have a very big tank. And I think it's worthwhile to put premium gas in that car.
Have you ever run regular in it? Can you tell the difference?
If I have, it's been years and years since I've put regular in it.
I have a Volt, requires premium because that engine only runs once in a while, and so they want good fuel, best fuel. So there's a case right there to be made that premium does make a difference, or that there is a value.
Well, I would say...
But I'm only using 4 gallons here and there.
Yeah, but you're familiar with the top-tier fuel rating, right?
Right. Okay.
Okay. So you can get premium fuel... If it's not top tier, it's not doing your engine any good. It could gum up.
Yeah. But so again, that gets back to it depends on where you buy. Most Americans go to the least expensive fuel they can get.
That's me.
And so that's might not be top tier.
Yeah.
Right?
And if you do an internet search, just type in top tier. They'll give you the whole list of brands that meet. It was a handful or two of the car companies that got together and said, look, whoever blends to this level, we'll call that top tier, and this is what we recommend that you run in your engine. It's got more detergents and blah, blah, blah.
So are these the brands like Shell and Mobil and Exxon and so
yes.
on?
Or,
okay.
Yes. I mean, you should look it up. I'm not sure that Mobil is on the list. I don't know.
Okay.
Shell is. BP is. With what do they call it, Ingenium or something like that?
Oh,
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know all
now
these gas brands.
Yeah, now you're talking Jag Land Rover engine.
Yeah.
Ingenium.
Yeah,
maybe
okay.
I am.
And they probably need it.
I had a strange experience. This may or may not apply, but I drove after our feature on the Fiat and the Miata. Drove our Four Seasons Miata cross country, and I had to stop for gas in Nebraska, and I found a couple of stations where. And they were kind of old, you know, kind of beat-up pumps. And it had regular gas, 89. It had a mid-range at 91 or something like that. And then it said premium, 85. So
ethanol.
It was probably, ethanol.
Yeah,
it was
ethanol.
That's right.
Maybe,
yeah.
But I don't...
But why would... But ethanol would go in all three grades, right? Why would...
No, it should boost it up considerably, you know, because ethanol is like 110 octane.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess what I'm saying is that there's an 80. So what you're running into is their top premium is 91.
Mm-hmm.
They just have 85 is below that 89 or 87. They offer it, but I think it's because it's a blend, so it's reading at 85, but it's
But we're all assuming that. What it said on the pump is accurate.
Right. I mean, and this happened at a couple of stations back to back. I think I had to go to a third, and I was running on fumes. But anyway, I don't want to.
It gets a little weird out there in the middle of Nebraska in the middle of the night looking for a gas
pump. Might be some of our viewers now.
They've been there. They live there.
Okay.
They know it.
All right.
So, yeah, I can see in a Volt where you don't run your gas engine very much or any kind of plug-in hybrid like that. Premium, certainly top-tier premium is good. Mm-hmm. I think if you're you've got a performance car with an aux sensor that can take advantage of the higher octane, advance the spark, get more power, then it's worth having it.
Yeah.
I think, by and large, the AAA is right. People are wasting their money on it. But the AAA test was just taking a handful of cars or so, throwing them on a chassis dyno and measuring. Well, crummy gasoline can start to build up deposits after 4,000 or 5,000 miles of driving. So I don't think the AAA test was necessarily as complete as it should be.
Well, I think that the takeaway certainly is if you have a car that does not require or recommend premiums, certainly do not.
Don't do it, right?
Yeah, there's not a...
Just go for the top tier stuff and buy the cheapest you can get.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's the point. Yeah, your good grades, I guess. Good fuel.
Because it's been up to a dollar more when...
Good fuel. Yeah,
it's been up to a dollar more when...
Premium is a major market.
Regular $2.50 or something like that.
Everything else came down, and premium is still... pushing $3 a lot of places.
Yeah.
So it did not decline.
Well, here's the thing is, we had Dan Nicholson on the show, I think it was earlier this year, and, he runs GM Powertrain. And what he was saying is we need premium fuel as the only fuel. If the car companies are going to meet the 2025 mm-hmm. CAFE, not just CAFE, but also CO2 emissions. We got to really bump up our compression ratios. Mm-hmm. And we can only do that if we've got higher octane fuel. Mm. And here's the biggest car company, certainly in this market, saying, hey, refiners, we need premium only. And, I wonder.
The refiners will be happy because they're selling oils trading for under $50 a barrel, and it's causing a lot of hardship in oil-producing states and countries, and they probably wouldn't mind that. But so that brings up an issue. There's been more and more talk about an uprising from the automakers against the 2025 CAFE, and I remember when the recommendations first came down and got us up to 2016, but there was also shortly after, this is what we're going to look at for 2025, and the number is 54.5, right? Yeah. And it sounded like at the time all the automakers were okay with that. I mean, they'd just been through the ringer.
Well, remember.
But they weren't selling the trucks that they're selling now.
Well, but there's a couple of things. You're right. Gas was expensive. It was over $4 across the country, $5 practically in places in California and the like. And they were just coming out of the bankruptcy and they had gotten billions of dollars from the government.
Yeah.
So the government says, thou shalt do this. And they went, okay, everybody shut up and just nod your head. Yes, we're going to go along with it. But they said, but we have to have a midterm review. So when we get out into 2016, 2017, we got to say, okay, is everything working? Should we proceed with this? And that's what we're in right now.
Which is what everybody's
talking about. So now you've got all the environmentalists coming out and saying, hey, these guys are way ahead of the game. They can absolutely do it. Everyone's going to save thousands of dollars if they buy these cars. And then you've got the car companies going, hey, have you guys looked at what's happening? Gas is $2 a gallon. Everyone's buying trucks, and nobody wants a hybrid.
But that skew, though, changes the number, reduces the number, because it's based on footprint and
that's true.
And volume. And so if you're a, like, for instance, FCA, getting out of small cars, and all they have to do is meet this bigger truck standard, which is somewhere below 54.5.
Way below.
Way below, while a company like Mazda has a much, has to meet that 54.
Right.
And a half.
Right.
So it's, first of all, they've said they can hit it. They know they can. They're able to do it soon. Something I've learned today is they're probably able to do it without the golden work of removing weight. They're taking out weight, but they're adding in all kinds of weight for entertainment systems and ADAS and all these different safety systems and things. And so the weight thing isn't going to solve it, yet they can still meet that standard.
Well, technologically, of course, they can meet it.
Yeah.
It's at what cost to the consumer.
Right.
That's what it really comes down to. And so far, they front-loaded CAFE on cars. So the heavy lifting for trucks really doesn't start until after 2018. Mm-hmm. And then it's the hockey stick. Then they really got to ramp up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And our truck buyer, I mean, I remember when Mark Royce was on the show, he says, after 2019, I don't see how you can meet CAFE with pickups without doing hybrids. I just don't see how you can do it.
And
is a truck buyer going to go for that?
Well, you're well,
only if they're all hybrids.
Is, no V8s.
Yeah.
There may not be.
And, you know, and Ford is blazing the trail there. I mean, the last Ford truck thing I went to, they talked about 75% of their F-150 sales are V6s.
Yeah.
Mostly turbo, but some of the naturally aspirated V6s, but 75%. Yeah. And people told them there is no way that truck buyers, F-150 buyers, are going to take a V6. They just won't do it. And here they're buying them, you know, 3 out of 4.
Yeah.
So that's going to help change that number. Now, what comes after that, you know, I don't know. Put a four-cylinder in an F-150?
Well, remember, too, this midterm review only looks at 2022 to 2025.
Right.
That's all they're looking at. It's nothing before 2022.
Right.
So,
yeah, but you have to take into consideration that a lot of those the advanced programs are inching toward those years already. Obviously,
they are. But EPA is taking away things. So right now, you're going to see flex fuel vehicles disappear. Why? Because the flex fuel credits are going away fast.
Yeah.
And that's why we've got millions and millions of flex fuel E85 capable vehicles on the road, because they got all kinds of fuel economy credits for making those vehicles.
Right.
Those are going away. So at the same time that the rules are getting tighter in terms of the number you have to meet in terms of MPGs, some would call them loopholes. The EPA calls them credits. The credits are going away. Some of the credits are going away.
Well, and I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that now you're talking about a buyer who, I hate to use these terms that are overused so much, but millennials, Generation X, who are much less resistant to thinking about, if I need a pickup in 2025, would I buy a four-cylinder hybrid full-size pickup? Or if I need a car and I live in the city or near the city, do I need one that has an engine at all? Do I just go with an electric motor? I
mean, they're battery. Right.
You know, this whole thing about, you know, nobody's buying electric cars now, not without some sort of push from California or the allure of the Tesla brand is, you know, in 5 or 10 or 15 years, the average aged buyer will say, yeah, what's wrong with an electric?
Right. Yeah, this is all going to skew rapidly, I think.
No, I think you guys could be right. Frankly, I'm a little bit puzzled why the industry is pushing back so hard on the standard. But I don't have access to all the data that they do.
I mean, I mentioned this earlier today in a presentation I was doing. It's that whole Bob Lutz model. Remember, Bob said, you know, the buying public is a size 14, and the government says, here's a size 4, fit into it, right? And that's a natural pushback from industry. We can't sell what you expect people to buy.
And you always want some leverage.
How do we do this?
You want to go into these negotiations with some leverage. You want to go into the midterm review saying, well, maybe let's make sure we can get we're not sure we can get through this, so let's talk about what little give you can give us, you know. And yeah. I think that's
I think they need to buy wiggle room. Let's say gas stays cheap. Let's say oil stays in at under $50 a barrel, even in the early 2020s. And let's say that people go, you know, these internal combustion engines have gotten so swell that I don't want electric. I don't want plug-in. I don't want batteries, you know, because they're too expensive or whatever. I'm with you guys. I think we're coming closer and closer to a tipping point where EVs will do well in the market. But if I'm sitting on multi-billion dollar investments, and they're going to chop my head off if my decisions go bad, I want more wiggle room.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's probably a lot of that pushback more than anything, is just having options to match the market.
So my recommendation would be, don't back off on the standards at all, but move the goalposts one design generation farther away. So move, instead of 2025, make it like 2028, 2029. So you don't back off the standards, but you give them another 3-4 years to meet them. I think it would make a huge difference for the industry.
I think there'd be a lot of resistance from the environmental community on that.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, on any kind of change.
No. I totally, in fact, because we did a show with Chris Grundler, who runs all this stuff for the EPA, and he says, listen, 2025, that's just step one.
Yeah.
You know, after 2025, we're coming out with the next round of standards.
It's all about time, and the message is, whether you believe it or not, and I accept global warming fully, human-caused global warming, that, you know, we only have so much time. So when you talk about the time factor rather than how can we adjust, give a little more wiggle room into the standard itself, I think that's a tougher sell, actually.
Mm. Yeah, no, I would agree with you, although I got to tell you, when you talk to the real climate change people, it's too late. We passed the tipping point.
Yeah.
What they say.
And a lot of melting going on.
Yeah. If you change one, my question would be, if you change the standard, the federal standard, that still doesn't change the ZEV state mandate.
California.
So
right.
That's what, you know, 25% of the market in those ZEV states.
16 states, I think.
No, you're totally right.
You know,
most East Coast.
So, and that's going to, you know, what are you going to do? Design something for them, but not for the rest of the country or the rest of the world?
Yeah.
You know,
that's
we're into a global design.
That's why CARB is really running the show here.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
no, in fact.
Like it or not.
And I think you nailed it, Bob, because I've been saying for a while now that the CAFE, the miles per gallon standard, is going to evolve into a CO2 standard.
Yeah.
That's what it's going to be.
Like the Europeans.
The Europeans. Exactly right. And we'll talk about grams per mile. And you two guys know as well as I do that there's such a direct correlation between reducing CO2 and boosting fuel efficiency.
Right.
I mean, the two go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But people understand pollution.
Right.
You know, we've trained them to learn, you know, miles per gallon. And the whole ZEV thing comes at it from a different direction, and that is going to rule the day.
Exactly right. Well, hey, we're going to have to wrap it up. It's been great having the two of you guys here.
You have more things on your list.
Well, we always run out of time before we run out of things to say.
Don't we have an hour overtime or something?
Yeah, don't we go? Yeah, extend.
Oh, wait a minute.
Us into another model show.
Oh, wait.
Speaking of football, I haven't worn this.
We
have, yes.
Oh, geez. Focus on this. Yes.
So everybody who's listening on the podcast, Todd has just put a cheesehead hat on his head because he's a Packers fan.
That's right.
And they're playing the Detroit Lions.
Dreadful Lions are about to go to Lambeau.
And I've got to see the offense pick it up because they need to pick it up again.
Here, you know?
That's probably from our three collies.
There we go.
No, I think it just looks like mold on cheese.
Beautiful
entirely thing. Appropriate.
And, you know, yes.
Well, thanks you guys for being here.
I need to bring that just for the record. Sorry. It's, you know, what good's a cheesehead sitting in your car?
Exactly. Sounds like
okay.
A country song.
Thanks you guys.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John.
I want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv. Yeah, one of the topics I wanted to get to, too, is the company's dropping out of the Paris Auto Show.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Lambo, Bentley, Volvo, Ford, saying we're not going. And, you know, there were those who dropped out of the Detroit show earlier this year.
Right, yeah.
Is this a trend?
Well, I think, yeah, I think that the, you know, heyday of the big auto show reveals is
coming to an end.
Coming to
the way
an
it's, end. The way it's all changed. I mean, you know, we go to a show, and whether it's here in Detroit or whether it's overseas someplace, as far away as Tokyo or Shanghai,
China. Yeah, right.
You know, everything gets released ahead of time. And we're looking at a car or truck up on the stand that's that they've spent thousands of dollars, maybe more, to unveil this thing and have a nice big show and all glitzy and everything. And meanwhile, we've got a web guy back in Detroit or L.A., you know, having typed out the story a day or two before on embargo and,
right.
and hitting a button and it appears on our websites.
Right. Yeah, and whether that has any value to them, you know.
I don't think it does. They're dropping out of the show.
Well, it doesn't have value to them, but then again, you know, we see no matter how many photos you send of the car ahead of time under embargo, no matter how flowery your PR prose is, we don't have a full clear opinion until we at least see the thing in the tin.
Right, yeah. but they can do that and get, I think, what they see is they can do that at, say, the GM Design Dome or, you know, at product development here at Ford and bring people in. If they're going to spend money, let's bring people in. We have their full attention. They're just writing about us. We get one big story from everybody instead of being a little speck in the middle of this whole ocean of all these.
That's true, Bob, but the one.
I think they feel like they're getting lost.
Yeah, but the one difference is that certainly in Detroit, and I'm sure, and we know it from Detroit because we live here, but probably the same thing with Frankfurt and Geneva, certainly, and Tokyo and Shanghai
Paris,
or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, maybe not so much Paris, and that may be the point, is that how much non-automotive press coverage do you get? I know the Detroit show does pretty well on your CNNs and in your Wall Street Journal and your New York Times and USA Today, whatever.
Right.
You get beyond the auto enthusiast and you get to the general public, the general media, the mass market media.
Right.
With
New
those.
York does a good job with that.
New York does a
good
job.
Yeah, but I think on a global basis, it's whittling down to two shows that will attract all the automakers.
Mm-hmm.
Frankfurt?
Yeah.
Because even though it's in Germany, it's really Europe's auto show.
It's Europe's auto show.
It's not Paris. It's not Geneva. It's Frankfurt and Shanghai.
You think?
I think those are the only two shows that will get all the brands to continue to go, at least for now.
Yeah, interesting.
But I would say those two plus Geneva and Detroit may remain important.
Very important.
Yeah.
I think Paris has long been a little bit more of a regional show.
Yeah.
Japan was like the canary in the coal mine,
look,
man.
Japan did such a great job of keeping all the foreign automakers out of their market.
Right, yeah.
No one else exhibits there, or very few, a few high ends, right? No other mass market.
Well, they had the big change in 2009. I've been to most of the Tokyo shows in the last decade and a half or so, fortunately. And they're every 2 years, for anybody who's listening and doesn't know that, is that 2007 you still had, I think even Chrysler under Cerberus at the time had a significant display there. And the European brands, Mercedes and BMW and Volkswagen, had significant displays there and had press conferences and so on. And you had the motorcycle exhibit was in a different building from the car exhibit. And then 2009, it was, you know, the world recession, global recession, and it was as dismal at the 2009 Tokyo show as it was at the 2009 and 2010 Detroit shows.
Yeah. Then they moved it too.
And then they moved it. And I've been to a couple of those.
Like hurried into town.
And the last one was a fairly, you had Mazda showing its, I forget the exact name, the rotary sports car concept.
Yeah,
and you had a couple of other things.
Well, the Japanese still take it seriously.
Oh, yeah,
they do.
Yeah.
But as you know, except for Mercedes and BMW and the like, Mm-hmm. None of the mass market brands.
That's true.
No one even goes there anymore. Right, yeah. It's like, let's go to Shanghai where we can sell cars. China, let us sell cars. Mm-hmm. Japan will not.
I think JAMA, the Japan Auto Manufacturers Association, yeah. I think they must have really pressured their core brands, Toyota and Honda and Nissan especially, to say, hey, let's keep this thing going. Yeah. And 2009 was a dismal show. 2011, I did not go to the Tokyo Motor Show. I don't think anybody went there from overseas. So by 2013, they were telling Toyota, Nissan, and Honda, and Mazda, and Mitsubishi, hey, why don't you host some overseas journalists and bring them over? Mm-hmm. And show them that we still have a show and that you have significant cars that you're unveiling here, mm-hmm. and save your best, one or two of your best concept cars for the Tokyo
something.
Show.
Yeah, yeah.
At this new place that's closer to downtown, you don't have to take a bus or a train all the way back to the airport to see it anymore, because you always stay in central Tokyo and then
yeah, right.
Have
I think
long ride.
Back to your point though of that. Some of these shows, the shows that get consumer interest, where they get past the automotive press to general interest.
That's very important.
That's the
critical
key. And the other element to that is those people covering a show, and like the, you know, no offense to the bloggers out there, but to the, you know, the mass blogosphere, most of them don't have any idea. You could show them a concept from 2 years earlier, mm-hmm. and say, this is brand new, and you'll get all kinds of coverage.
Anything that's shiny and bright get coverage.
So, you know, you can, it's almost like you can forget about the automotive press. We'll cater to them in a different way. We'll bring them to see the real future product. And
I submit as evidence.
You could bring them to one location and get one big bang out of it for the same money that you spend to try to bring people to an auto show and break through the clutter. Instead, let all these consumer writers and publications have that. You know,
and what show has focused on that is Chicago,
and that's
a perfect example, because they claim to be the largest consumer
public
show,
attendance of the year in
the U.S. and North America, and they get us to I haven't missed one in 20 years, yeah. and you've missed a few, but we go there and there are a few new introductions. A lot of them are trim levels, but we go there.
Well,
we spend a couple of days.
That's what I was going to say. You do a special edition of a Mustang to a consumer crowd, consumer journalist, to the blogosphere, and get all kinds of hits. And we look at it and go,
right.
I mean, show us something new.
Yeah. What I see happening is that for the public, auto shows are really important.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the car companies look at it. For the media, other than the non-automotive media, for the automotive media, they're going, you know, we're not getting much bang for the buck here. And you mentioned earlier in the show, Further with Ford, this program that we went to last week. I think we're going to see more of that, where Ford brings everybody to their campus, holds them captive for an entire day. Two dinners, you fly in, you have dinner, you get a presentation. The next day you go and look at all this stuff. You have another dinner, and then you fly home. Just like the tech companies do it. Apple and Google.
Yep.
Apple and Google don't go to CES. They bring the media to their tech days. Yeah. And I think we're going to see the automakers doing more and more of that, where they know they've got a captive automotive audience.
Right.
And I got to tell you, I didn't know I didn't know 80% of the...
wasn't all automotive. That's the thing, is that they're bringing in a lot of people that are,
lifestyle.
Urgent.
Right.
They
Ford's been doing that a lot, even on its drive programs.
Right.
And, right. Yeah.
But I'm telling you, I was at that program last week. I bet you I didn't know 80% of the media in the audience.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Some interesting stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Sure, yeah. So it's interesting. You've got Silicon Valley trying to get into the auto business.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've got Detroit and Stuttgart and Tokyo looking at how can we market ourselves more like Silicon Valley, mm-hmm. you know, to your point about Google and Apple not going to CES but doing their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, they're all looking at that model. It's all and this has been they've been talking about this for years. At one point, it was, well, how do we make our interiors look more like an Apple store, you know?
Yeah, right.
And now...
how do we make our dealerships look more like an Apple store?
Well, yeah. And so, you know,
Hey, we're in a lot of change, and nobody knows where it's going, really. I mean, everyone's got ideas as to what they should be working on, but they don't know where it's really going to go. And that's why we're seeing, you know, as we were talking earlier, GM, Ford, and all jumping into all this autonomy and mobility services. They know we better jump into the pool right now because we could get our clocks cleaned. This thing could just wipe us out completely in a decade.
Moving very fast, right. Faster than I think anybody quite has a grasp. And we're in the middle of it. So we're driving a lot of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
boy, you know, you go out to somebody whose car's, you know, your average 11 and a half years old or whatever, they've not experienced any of this.
They don't even have a backup camera.
Well, let me put up a red flag here, by the way. So speaking of this Ford event, which I wasn't able to attend, but I've been to others like that at Ford. You know, what I worry about, and especially looking at the Silicon Valley model, is how much more easily, and you raised this point earlier, how much more easily they can control their own messages by doing shows like that. It's a much different atmosphere at an auto show where you walk the floor and you run into people and you run into a competitor who, you know, they don't like to, certainly on the record, say anything bad about their competitors.
But off the
record,
say,
well, hey, did you see, what are they thinking with on that huge grill or something like that? Or whatever it is, and picking up little tidbits and sometimes rumors or even scoops and so on, right. Inside stories, and you don't have that at things like
great
this.
Point.
And
it's, and great
it
point.
Also makes me think of Tesla's what is his new his the new plan Pardieu, which was broadcast on the interwebs, and no, that's what they call it, Pardieu, DEAUX, And it was on at the same time as a GOP. No, it was on during one of the conventions this last summer, and just watching it on the web, you saw and you heard this crowd just full of Tesla fanboys just cheering at every other word mm-hmm. spoken. And you know, I fear that along with the bloggers. Who again are attracted to anything shiny and bright and think it's new and will say nothing but good things about them because their own car at home is 11 years old and doesn't have that backup camera. Show them any bit of shiny tech and they'll be saying wonderful things about it just to sell a Ford or a Chevy or a Toyota or any one of those cars.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. That is a real danger.
Your point hits on exactly why a car company would bail out of an auto show.
Yes.
Right.
Why put my stuff out there so that my, you know, competitors off the record can run around and snipe at it or that things can, you know, get
look, Lamborghini
spun by someone else. We want to do all that spin in-house, in our own place, you know.
Lamborghini and Bentley are part of Volkswagen Group, of course, and Volkswagen Group always had, presumably until now, this big...
The cluster,
the night before the show.
Group night.
Where they...
You will come to group night.
They would show a car from each of its divisions, and my favorite is still the Skoda with the ice scraper that tucks into the... fuel filler flap. That was the best thing they ever showed.
But you
sit or stand through this long
Frankfurt
flog. Maybe. And you sit through this long flog all night. And now Volkswagen can't. They say they can't afford to pay for that, right? Because the Dieselgate. So there's an excuse for not doing group night, and then if you're not doing group night, well, maybe we shouldn't, you know, if Lamborghini and Bentley have nothing
people,
new.
An auto show, if we're not going to
Oh, the investment them. For a stand is in the millions.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know this, now this date is a little bit old, but 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, if you wanted chairs at your press conference in your stand in Cobo Hall, it was $80 a chair,
yeah.
$100 a table.
Yep.
And, you know, you look at that stuff, and I know from North American Car and Truck of the Year Awards, we wanted to move six vehicles into Cobo for the Economic Club to announce the finalists. It was $12,000 to move six cars into the building.
Well,
so you look at those kinds of costs, and you go, what are we doing here?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the old example that you might remember is Volkswagen when it introduced the new Beetle. This is way back in 1998 or 99, 98, had a separate section of Cobo Hall. You had to take an escalator down from the regular Volkswagen stand to get to the...
Yeah.
And they had all this interactive stuff, and they were stamping out little Volkswagen Beetle
plastic
pencil cases and that sort of thing.
Yep.
And the number that I've always heard connected to that was $23 million, just on the... On the Beetle stand alone, and that was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
No, close to 20 years ago.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah.
So, you know, again, it just says, are we getting the return that we're putting in for this stuff? For the public days, do it. But for the media, not so sure.
Yeah.
That for the public days, you have to do some of that
stuff. And you have that whole changeover, too. If you just do a show for the public, you know, then you don't have...
Well, as you guys know, it takes six weeks to set up that show. I mean, they build a little city. Every single year, they build a whole new city inside Cobo Arena.
Well, then the crazy thing then is changing it over to the public.
Changing it over from press days to public days. Or changing it over from press to charity preview to public days.
Right, right.
Because otherwise you still have, you know, you still have to have some of those glitzy, interactive sort of things where you hire a lot of... interns, I guess, to tell something about the car, hand out a little toy that you know, a toy Dodge or something, and because otherwise you have just, you know, one big showroom. Otherwise, that's all it is.
Right, well, cars on a carpet. Right,
right, right. Well, and what have we seen over time? All of the companies like Volkswagen Group Night doing something off-site, away from the show, and again, with what intention? To try to get certain, you know, get your attention in their space
as long
as possible.
And I think one thing we haven't hit on yet is that, I think at least the old guard, the guys our age and maybe older, are still like that sort of stuff. It's not just for us, but it's also for the executives and the engineers and the designers.
Oh, yeah, this is not going to go away overnight.
Right.
Oh, no.
But when you start hearing Lambo's not there, Volvo's not there, Bentley's not there, Ford's not there, and we're starting to see show after show where this sort of thing is starting to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
The writing's on the wall.
Yeah. Big holes opening up.
Yeah.
But I still see, for a long, long time, I could see where it pares down to maybe those four shows, to Geneva, Detroit, Frankfurt, and Shanghai.
Shanghai or...
Would it be Shanghai or Beijing, or would they keep going back and forth?
Not Beijing. I was at Beijing this year. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Holy
moly. I did two of those, and there, the first round was the famous carpet... Greg Cable and I must have walked a mile of sudsy red carpet. It was like somebody had cleaned it but not sucked the suds back out. And it was wet. It was raining, right? It was raining. And where we were dropped off, first of all, it took 4 hours to drive to the show.
Now you're talking Beijing.
In Beijing.
Yeah.
And then they drop us off, and the entrance is somewhere over there. And we start walking, and it's...
Yeah.
I mean, it was probably a mile slogging this sudsy red carpet. We get to the show and we have, you know, 45 minutes to cover things basically, and then we're getting out of here, you know.
Well, but you mentioned Beijing, and I didn't go this year, but I was there 2 years ago on a Lincoln trip. And
2 years ago was not bad. This was
Years. 2 years ago was bad if you mean crowds.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But right, wait a minute.
Yeah.
So now you were saying nobody wants to. It's the Yogi Berra thing. Nobody goes there anymore. It's too crowded.
Yeah, right.
So you'd say, well, yeah, why are they doing these big displays when it's so crowded and nobody can walk? Well,
right.
That's
yeah.
why.
Yeah.
That's I mean,
yeah.
you know, obviously yeah. in Beijing, part of the problem was that by 10 a.m., it was not only media allowed in, but
you can buy
everybody.
Tickets.
Anybody who you can
As
buy
a member
tickets.
Of the public, you yeah. can buy tickets to Media Day.
Yeah.
yeah.
So it's jam-packed.
Oh, yeah. There were huge.
But I'm not even talking about that. I don't mind the crowd so much. The venue is a dump
well,
in
yeah.
Beijing,
yeah. right.
not Shanghai.
Yeah.
Beijing.
And that's the new venue, too.
I know.
Yeah.
I think it was built in like 2008, 2009.
Well, yeah.
It was slapped together because it's falling apart.
Oh, yeah. It's a mess. Yeah. You wonder what are they thinking there? They put everything into the Olympics, into the bird's nest, and that's fallen down, too, I think. They can't go near it. They can't use it.
Hey, let's wrap up so we can let the crew. They got to get the car out of the studio. And,
oh, this was fun.
Yeah. It's always good.
Oh, yeah. Good stuff. Okay.
You might have to turn this into a 2-hour show pretty soon.
At this rate.
At least when you have Bob and myself on because we talk too much.
Yeah, we
jabber a lot.
Yeah.
It's always good. I didn't know.
So we got to think of a title for this show.
Beats having quiet people on, doesn't it?
Oh, yes.
This is,
you know, we never have that problem or rarely have that problem with one of the journalists.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah, if your personal turned up just writing things, we want to say something.
Huh? No, actually, it's kind of like
we like being unedited.
From time to time.
Right.
Yeah, this is a good.
Hey, how are you?
How could it have gone?
Maybe.
Did it slip between here?
Yeah. Let me go put the stuff down at all.
It's, that's a note.
Oh, wait,
that's
a
note.
I got it. Never mind.
Okay, good.
All right. Sorry. I do this all the time. Where is it? It's in my hand.
Yeah.